Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. We have a busy docket for you today, January 10th, 2022. First, Letitia Stauch doesn't want to come to court, and some other interesting motions that have been filed on her behalf. We'll talk about Lori Vallow. The court amended that order to make sure Mark Means stays canceled. We also have Alex Murdoch. Was he going to get a bond? Let's wait and see. Some senseless violence in New York. Some information on the shopping cart killer. A story that just goes into the you can't make this up category. Robert Durst is finally dead. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. And yes, in 2022, we are still the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel that you look for your news and analysis when it comes to the law. Okay, let's get to it. But real quick, if you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button, hit that little bell so you receive notifications when we go live or put up new content. And remember, tomorrow, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, every Tuesday, 6 p.m., we go live. Immediately following that, we have our Patreon show for all our Patreons. So if you haven't become a Patreon, well, you probably should. All right, let's get to it today. Letitia Stauch. You remember Letitia Stauch. This case seems like it is just drug on and on and on. Well, I think it's going to continue to drag on. The defense has filed some motions. They filed motions. They were due December 28th. All right. What did the motions indicate that we can learn from this case by the motions filed? Well, first, the first one that the defense filed was a request that Letitia Stauch not have to come to the next court hearing. Now, the defense attorneys have communicated with Ms. Stauch, and it is her desire to not appear in person at the hearing due to her mental health and stress that an in-court appearance will place on such. That's their words, not mine. Now, defense counsel is prepared to proceed to hearing without the presence of the defendant, and they do note that the chief judge down there in El Paso County canceled all of the jury trials as of January 3rd because of the continuing COVID-19 pandemic. The council also notes in their filings that many of the wards at the El Paso County Jail are currently quarantined, and many of the in-custody defendants are not being transported because of the rapid spread of the Omicron variant. Now, what's interesting about that? Really, Letitia Stauch doesn't want to go to court because it basically stresses her out and it affects her mental health. Well, Ms. Stauch, and you know, the attorney's got to do what they got to do. They're doing what they can for their client. But guess what? You're charged with first degree murder. It's supposed to be stressful. That's part of the harassment package, so to speak. It's part of the justice process. And I don't know what the judge will do. Frankly, if I was the judge, I would have her show up in court so there's no issues down the road as to whether this was a knowing voluntary waiver. And if the court is even considering it, the court should conduct that colloquy, that engagement, conversation with Ms. Stauch in person, on the record, making sure she wasn't going to be able to come back later and say, I didn't understand. Additionally, the defendant needs to be there for trial. The only way a defendant is usually excused from their own trial is if they are disruptive during that trial. But Ms. Letitia Stauch, she needs to go to court, okay? Bottom line, that's just the way it is. So what other motions did the defense file in this case? Well, they filed a motion to suppress the search of the Apple iPhone 8, a motion to suppress the ADT security system, a motion to change venue, and a motion for expert discovery. And there's also a motion to suppress wiretaps. That's right. They tapped Letitia Stauch's phone because, well, lack of communications. So let me explain wiretaps, ladies and gentlemen. It used to be really difficult for the government to get a wiretap, right? You actually had to go plug in buttons and do all this crazy stuff at the phone connection center to do a wiretap. It was frankly quite complicated. Now the only thing that's really complicated about getting a wiretap these days is the amount of paperwork that is required that is usually cut and paste from another case, and they throw in some facts. Now, what do they have to show in a wiretap application? The government has to show that basically all normal investigative techniques have failed. And therefore, the only thing that we could possibly do was to tap somebody's phone so that we could listen to the call. Now, usually the wiretap application is about 50 pages long, and they have to give you all this information saying this is the facts of the case, and judge, we just can't get it, but we know if we were able to listen in on these calls that we'd be able to do it. Now, how do you suppress a wiretap investigation and an actual wiretap so that none of the wiretaps could be used against you? Well, in this particular case, you have to say that there's no probable cause. Like, hey, there's no crime being committed. Kind of a weak argument, and it's pretty weak in this affidavit. And I'm not trying to criticize these motions, but we challenge wiretaps pretty regularly, and I got a pretty good motions guy, and he would, this looks a little boilerplate. That's all I'm saying. I think it's a little boilerplate. But then they have to show that that these normal investigative techniques would fail. Well, what are new normal investigative techniques? Well, basically, you couldn't put an undercover officer into talk with somebody in this particular case. Now, but you still have to articulate the reasons why you wouldn't be able to do that. And here the defense says, Detective Bethel, B-E-T-H-E-L, fails to provide any facts to back up this belief, where he says that no agent could possibly get close enough to Miss Stauch in any way. Well, I don't know why they just don't go over and maybe buy her dinner. It worked in the Barry Morphew case. You remember that? They just kept going over, asking him. Next thing you know, he's inviting him over for dinner. Could have tried that, I guess. In this particular case, the defense then says, well, there wasn't a whole lot of forensic testing of physical evidence. And their motion states that the affidavit talks of the use of forensic testing of physical evidence and admits that the evidence has been collected and sent off for testing. The affidavit then states that the tests take time, but fails to elaborate on the specific test or possible time parameters. Kind of weak arguments, interviews, and grand jury. Well, Detective Bethel admits that these close friends and associates of Ms. Stauch could potentially be successful in achieving the goals of the investigation, and this statement flies in the face of the necessity requirements, right? You're going to the court to get a wiretap by a court to listen to your deepest, darkest conversations, right? You have a general expectation of privacy that when you're talking on the phone that nobody's listening. So it's very invasive to do that. And I mean, this is neither a case where, frankly, lack of cooperation, but I mean, it's a criminal investigation. The defendant has a right not to testify. She moves out of state because she wasn't under arrest. They think they could talk to her friends, but they're not going to do it. Pretty weak case, in all honesty, for a wiretap. Now, I don't know what evidence they got from the wiretap because, well, they don't really outline that in the motion, which is kind of why it's kind of weak, because usually you want to tell the judge what evidence was obtained shouldn't be considered, not just all of it, unless you're just saying it fails for probable cause, which I guess is what they're saying here, but it's still kind of weak. The next motion, a change of venue. Now, I just drafted one of these change of venue motions, and you need to put a lot of information in there. You can't just basically say, hey, there's been a lot of pre-trial publicity. You have to basically give a lot of statistics. What's the population in El Paso County? What is the subscription of the local newspaper down there? What is the potential jury pool? You have to put some real work into these types of things by calling the jury commissioner, collecting each and every newspaper article to show that somehow there's going to be so much publicity that, judge, now you should have to do this and grant a motion for change of venue. And let me tell you one more thing. This motion should have been filed months and months ago, because per statute, it is, or per the rule, you have to move for motions for change of venue at arraignment, or you have to show good cause. Normally, the judges will let you get by with it. And I'm telling you, I've only had one change of venue ever granted early on. Normally, what happens is you wait and see, and it takes place in smaller communities. You wait and see whether there is a problem getting potential jurors in the case that haven't heard about it or formed an opinion. In a larger jurisdiction like El Paso County there in Colorado, pretty big jurisdiction, I'm sure you're going to find people that haven't heard about Letitia Stauch in any way whatsoever. Now, the warrant to suppress the affidavit as it relates to the search warrant from ADT, this is attacking a general warrant, okay? What does that mean? Under the Fourth Amendment, let's pull out our handy dandy Fourth Amendment. Fourth Amendment clearly states the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall means mandatory, not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons to be seized. The warrant that was searched in the ADT matter, in the application for a search warrant, well, this is a general search warrant. It basically says, hey, I'm a police officer, and I would like to believe that there is material evidence of a subsequent criminal prosecution required or permitted by statute. That's it. And it basically just says, I want to search ADT. He states in the affidavit that during the subsequent 40-hour period, Ms. Stauch refused to meet with the sheriff's office or provide the requested information regarding her stepson. She doesn't have to. At that point, she's subject to an investigation. And so it goes through the application, pretty generic, and basically it says, Ms. Stauch said she left the house and went shopping and came home at approximately 14:30 hours, which is 2:30 p.m., and Ms. Stauch disarmed her ADT security system upon entering the house and went downstairs. While downstairs, she met with an unknown man who pointed a handgun at her. The man allowed her to go upstairs to greet her stepdaughter, Linnea. Ms. Stauch said she sent Linnea outside to ride her bike. Then it says the Stauch residence is protected with an ADT system and that records entrance. The document goes on, the affidavit for the search warrant says that the Stauch residence is protected with an ADT system that records entrances and exits from the home. The system also contains information on when it is armed in stay or away mode. Ms. Stauch reported disarming the system and placing it in the stay mode. Now, what's interesting is that this is a very generic application, and in there they basically said they want all the account information, any audio or video, any log history, any activation or deactivation, passcodes assigned to a particular date. You know how this could potentially fail? Is that they weren't specific as it relates to the date that they're seeking. Although they give a general background in the attachment saying, you know, January 27th, January 28th, they don't actually ask for that in the attachment, which is all the things specifically requested. The defense may have an argument here. Now, whether a judge will throw that out, I don't know. Like I said, you have to be specific. When a government agent says, we're going to look for something, they have to say, we're going to look for a specific thing that we know we're going to find it. That's why phone searches get thrown out pretty regularly, because they say, we're just going to search the phone. We're going to go rummage around in there until we find what we're looking for. You can't do that. You have to be specific. We want a text message between this person and this person on a specific date. You don't get to go rummage and say, we know it when we see it. That's exactly what the Fourth Amendment provides against. We'll see what happens there as well. That is the same argument that the defense makes as it relates to the search of Ms. Letitia Stauch's cell phone. You have to be very specific in the application of what you're going to seize. And I'll be honest with you, this is about the time period where law enforcement here in Colorado was screwing up their affidavits, basically saying, let me search the phone. Judges were rubber stamping it. And the Colorado Supreme Court said, you can't do that. That's a general search. Guess what? Case goes away. I'm sorry. Guess what happens when it's a general warrant? Everything from that phone could be suppressed. What does suppress mean? It means the prosecution cannot use it in its case in chief. Could be potentially bad for the prosecution in this particular case. We will see if the prosecution bothers with filing a written response. So many times the prosecution does not file written responses. I don't understand that. You have to ask for it these days, or you have to go to federal court where it's expected that the prosecution file a written response. We'll watch how the court deals with the motions hearing. The motions in this particular case are to be heard on January 13th. Unfortunately, we can't bring it to you live, but we will be watching for sure. All right. Maybe now it's finally getting interesting because this case goes back a long way, ladies and gentlemen, a long way. All right, next on the docket. Boy, the courts have been busy. Lori Vallow, the court has finally amended the protective order to make it absolutely clear. That's right. That Mark Means. We should just call this not the protective order. We should just call this the Mark Means protective order. And what does the amended protective order state? It states that no person having access to the discovery in this matter, including but not limited to the state, defendants, defendants' current or former counsel, and any employee of or agent thereto, or any third party, shall disseminate or disclose any of the information, documents, recordings, or other material contained in the discovery to any third party not directly participating in this legal action. I thought the previous protective order was clear on that, but the prosecuted one wanted further clarification, and now it's absolutely clear that evil former counsel cannot disseminate it, because that is the prosecution's worst fear, is that rogue Mark Means is going to somehow not abide by the protective order and release it to other people. We shall see. Next on the docket. Well, there was a hearing today regarding Alex Murdoch. What kind of hearing could you possibly ask for? Well, that's right. Mr. Murdoch wants to go home. He has grown tired. He has grown tired of sitting in custody. So what actually took place? Well, apparently the hearing went for about an hour and a half, and it got a little tense at a point when the South Carolina Attorney General's office and Murdoch's attorneys took some testimony from witnesses, and then the court ultimately said that she would issue a ruling shortly, but it's going to be a written hearing. Now, according to reports from the hearing, there was testimony from John T. Lay, who's one of the attorneys assigned to comb through Murdoch's frozen assets. Then they had Eric Bland and Justin Bamberg, attorneys for several alleged victims of Murdoch, and a South Carolina Highway Patrol lieutenant who was injured in the line of duty and went to the Murdoch for help with a workman's compensation claim. Lieutenant Thomas Moore said that Murdoch was always nice to him and he trusted him. Now he has to face the fact that the attorney took advantage of him and stole money from his recovery settlements. That's right. The prosecution also brought up jail calls. Now, what have we said? And I tell this to everybody in custody, and they never listen to me because nobody ever listens to their criminal defense attorney. And that's why defense attorneys have to say, I told you, man, don't do that. And I know Murdoch's attorney said, don't talk on the phone. They listened to it. Back in the old days, just like wiretaps, it was a big deal to get jailhouse calls. Now, it's like downloading something from, you know, iTunes to listen to it. It's that simple. So the attorneys thought that it would be interesting for the judge to hear some of the jail phone calls in which the state obviously is accused him of behaving like a man who believed he had access to his assets, noting that Murdoch mentioned his $2.2 million retirement account and has told family members to go ahead and spend some money on golf. You know how stressful these legal proceedings could be, so go spend some money. He says the calls don't seem to be from someone who is destitute, according to the prosecutors, who has less than $10,000, as his attorneys have alleged. It was stated that Alex Murdoch is heard on jail calls telling family members to spend money because he has it worked out. Specifically, Alex Murdoch is heard on the phone telling relatives, you need me to send you $4,000 or $5,000 for golf. I don't want you to play golf without at least being able to get some drinks at the bar and a souvenir shirt. Yeah, it's always the defendant's own words that come back and haunt them, like I've said before, right? Now, of course, the defense said, hey, Mr. Murdoch is not a danger to the community, and this is just all a bunch of newspapers trying to create problems for Mr. Murdoch. Well, let's just say things maybe I don't think are going to go the way Mr. Murdoch wants them to. Now, there's been some interesting news that has come out. Now, I think this is interesting. You say, why, Scott, is this interesting? A Hampton Bank CEO was fired as investigators examined Alex Murdoch's financial misconduct. Well, that's interesting, right? South Carolina, old school, all right? You got to have the right pedigree. So the Hampton Bank CEO was under scrutiny and named in a subpoena by the disciplinary arm of the state Supreme Court there in South Carolina. And they asked for some documents via a subpoena. Well, what could they possibly be asking for, you might add? Let me tell you. This subpoena sent by the Supreme Court Office of Attorney Regulation, that's the people that take away attorneys' licenses when they do bad things. That's right. Listen to what they're asking for. A complete copy of the files from the bank's CEO. Any proceedings in the matters regarding Russell Lateef, where the bank was appointed and or served as the conservator for Natasha Thomas. Any proceedings matters in which Russell Lateef was appointed and or served as the conservator for Shakira Pinckney. Any proceedings in which Russell Lateef served as the personal representative of an estate. And any proceedings in which Chad Westendorf served as a conservator representative for an estate. And all proceedings regarding the estate of Hakeem Pinckney, Robert Williams, Blondell Gary, and the estate of Sandra Taylor. So what does the issuance of these subpoenas mean, as well as the fact that, well, the CEO was fired? What's the significance of the CEO? Well, this bank was started just a couple of years before the Murdoch Law Firm was started, back in like 1903 and 1907, respectively. They probably spent all their time at the country club growing up together. And what does it show? Just what I mentioned was going to take place a while back. That is that this is going to get ugly for a lot more people, more than just Alex Murdoch. This wasn't a one-time isolated incident. This was a situation where this was literally a criminal enterprise between banks, Alex Murdoch, as well as others who were involved in this scheme to basically milk people out of their settlements from these personal injury settlements. This is going to get huge. And I would mark my word that some guy that works in a bank that his family's owned since 1903, even though he got fired, he probably doesn't want to go to prison. And what's that going to mean? That means he is going to roll. That's right. Sing like a canary against Alex Murdoch. We will just have to wait and see. But I told you this was getting good. The judge didn't rule on her motion today for the bond reduction from $7 million to something more amenable to Mr. Murdoch's beer and peanuts budget that he has now of, you know, like $10,000 or something along those lines. I somehow think Alex Murdoch may get a little relief, like, you know, the bond being reduced to, say, $5 million. We'll just have to wait and see. All right, next on the docket. Well, some more senseless violence. And I'm not sure in New York this is even considered a crime much anymore. We talked about that the other day, where the district attorney is basically saying no one goes to prison for more than 20 years. Even if you go in and rob somebody, maybe it gets a little more complicated when somebody passes away. But we'll have to wait and see. So a Burger King cashier by the name of Crystal Bayron Nieves, 19, was working as a cashier at a Burger King at the 116th Street and Lexington Avenue in East Harlem early Sunday morning when an armed robber entered the restaurant around 1 a.m. The teenager recently moved with her family from Puerto Rico to New York seeking a better life. Now, Bayron Nieves had started the night shift at Burger King 3 weeks ago and had already requested for more security or to move shifts because she feared for her safety when she was leaving the restaurant. So on the night at issue, at around 1 a.m., the gunman pistol whipped a male customer before punching a female manager in the face. The teenager handed over $100 cash from the drawer. The robber turned to leave, then turned around and shot Bayron Nieves in the chest. She was transported to a nearby hospital where she was pronounced dead. Now, Bayron Nieves recently earned her GED and took the job at the fast food chain to help buy a car. Bayron Nieves was afraid of working night shifts and was set to change schedules on Friday, but she wouldn't make it to Friday. Now, the new New York mayor, Eric Adams, visited the scene on Sunday in Harlem to pay his respects. He tweeted, "My prayers are with you and all of Crystal's family. This is why I'm so committed to combating the illegal guns coming in our community." Now, the robber is yet to be identified or apprehended, and the investigation continues. Even if he was apprehended, I'm sure the new district attorney there will say, "Is this really even a crime?" Well, yes, it is. It's first-degree murder, and that person should probably spend, if not their entire life, the better part of it in prison for the complete senseless act of violence. All right, let's talk about the shopping cart murders. Well, the shopping cart killer, cops have positively identified two more women as being victims of the shopping cart killer. They were both found in a container near the Moon Inn Hotel in Alexandria, Virginia on December 15th. Stephanie Harrison, 48, from Redding, California, and Cheyenne Brown, 29, from Washington, D.C. Authorities are asking for the public's help for any information they know about the alleged serial killer, Anthony Eugene Robinson, who's 35. Police announced last Friday that he used the Plenty of Fish and tagged dating apps to lure victims. For now, Robinson only faces charges in Harrisburg, Virginia, for allegedly murdering local woman Aline Elizabeth Redmond, 54, and Charlottesville residents Tonita Laurice Smith, who was 39. The two women were killed at separate times, but police believe that Robinson moved at least one of the victims in a shopping cart, hence the nickname the shopping cart killer. Now, Robinson remains at the Rockingham County Adult Detention Center on two counts of murder and two counts of felony disposal of human remains. Charges are pending in Fairfax County, and he is the only suspect in the Brown and Harrison murders. And the Fairfax County Police Major Ed O'Carroll said there also could be a fifth victim in Washington, D.C., though he declined to make any identification. A woman was found dead in a shopping cart only covered with a blanket, is what he told police. Brown, who was 4 months pregnant, and Harrison were found in a container near the Moon Inn Hotel in Alexandria, Virginia. Robinson was the last person to be seen with Cheyenne when she was alive. They communicated through a dating app, Plenty of Fish. Robinson had stayed at the Moon Inn Hotel 6 times, including the day Brown went missing. Police voiced concern that there could be more victims, survivors, and others who communicated with Robinson. This includes Plenty of Fish, Tagged, or other dating apps. Wow, how is that a segue for CrimeTalkSearch.com? Please go to CrimeTalkSearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about what was in their background, now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched, and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever. But if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship. You're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. All right. From the you can't make this up category, here it is. Pennsylvania police officers captured video of a passenger removing a live deer, that's right, a deer, like Bambi kind of deer, from the trunk of a vehicle during a traffic stop. The driver was suspected of being under the influence of drugs or alcohol when the officer noticed that the live animal was in the back of the vehicle. The driver told the officer that they had struck the deer with the vehicle before placing it in the hatchback area. The woman behind the wheel and her passenger apparently thought the deer was dead, but after a short ride, they realized that the deer was in fact not dead, but continued to drive with the animal in the vehicle anyway. Now, the video shows the passenger of the vehicle, described only as a 21-year-old from York Haven, hoisting the deer from the rear of the car as officers stood nearby with the flashlights. Now, the deer started to kick its legs before allowing the man to carry it across the road and out of the view of the camera. Police said a 19-year-old woman was behind the wheel, and she was taken into custody for what officers described as a DUI investigation. Well, I think the defense attorney in that case is going to have some pretty good cross-examination. This person kept the car in between the lanes, no disruptive driving whatsoever. Why? Because she had a deer in her car, and if you can stay in the lanes with a deer in the car that's alive or dead, guess what? You're probably not drunk. We'll have to wait and see. You just can't make this stuff up. All right. Robert Durst, probably one of the worst human beings in the history of mankind, right? We'll go into this later on another show, but this guy is the ultimate dirtbag, and he's a dirtbag with money, which is probably why he got away with it for so long. All right. Robert Hurst is dead. The witch is dead. Robert Durst is dead. The New York real estate scion, who was recently convicted of his friend's murder, has died. Durst was sentenced to life in prison back in October for the killing of his longtime friend, Suzanne Berman. Soon after his conviction, he was indicted for the 1982 murder of his wife, Kathleen Durst. Durst was housed at the state jail facility in Stockton that provided long-term medical care. His health was declining, and he was placed on a ventilator after testing positive for COVID-19. He was also battling bladder cancer. The 78-year-old Durst died of natural causes Monday at 6:44 a.m. Now, if you saw his sentencing when he was in the wheelchair, he looked like he was already dead. And at least the prosecutors went forward with the case. They got a conviction. That case was so weird. It was basically stopped for 14 months because of COVID. And then they just resumed like it was no big deal. Very interesting set of circumstances, but Robert Durst is dead. Finally, are the words that come to my mind. All right, next on the docket, the dumb criminal of the day. Now, police allegedly found a bag of methamphetamine in the pocket of a 37-year-old Brandon C. Hack, C-I-H-A-K, found in his pockets, and the Minnesota man did what anyone would do. That's right. Those aren't my pants defense. Now, Sihak was searched during a traffic stop, and Officer Eric Lopez said that Sihak claimed he was wearing someone else's pants. Sihak is 5'11 and tried to pin the pants on a man who was only 4'1" tall. Now, Sihak was charged with felony narcotic possession and was booked into the county jail. Ladies and gentlemen, every attorney has tried the that ain't my pants defense. It used to be when, like, cocaine was like felonies in most places. People go into bars and the bouncers would search them and they pull out cocaine and then they would charge people with it. That was the golden age of that ain't my pants, bro. Usually it didn't work because, you know. Now here, Sihak, 5'11, the man who had the pants, 4'1. Now, I think it's more likely that the 4'1 guy, which is extremely small, he'd probably have bigger pants because you can't get pants that can't fit. Now, if the other guy was like 6'6", it'd be unlikely that those were his pants. So Mr. Sihak may have an issue here. I say go with the that ain't my pants, bro defense. We'll watch and see what happens to Mr. Sihak. Can't make this stuff up, ladies and gentlemen. I love this stuff. All right. That's all we have for you today. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.